Tobacco Road. Yeah, no problem there. I can identify. Yeah, Lou Rawls coming through loud and clear. Tobacco Road. Yeah, welcome our guests to Recovery Radio. I'm James and my friend John will be hosting the show this evening. So sit back, buckle up, and listen up. Got a special guest coming on too as well around 5 or 10 minutes into the show. She'll be popping in and talking to us about the youth. But in the meantime, John, tell me something about, you were talking about a social justice event. You want to speak a little on that? That you went to that involved...
Yeah. Well, let me do two things at once here. John Unger, a friend of both of ours, former state senator, pastor at three Harpers Ferry churches. I see a Lutheran, and he's, I think, ordained Lutheran. The Episcopal Church in Harpers Ferry, and the Methodist Church in Harpers Ferry, because of a peculiar communion of communions between those three denominations, where Lutherans share communion with the Episcopal and the Methodists, but the Episcopal don't share with the Methodists, and the Methodists don't share with the Episcopal.
You lost me, man.
Find a priest.
You lost me.
All three parishes. But it could administer Holy Communion in all three parishes. And the only one that could do it is a Lutheran, because they're the only ones that share with both the others. Their doctrine, they have a doctrinal decision at the top of their decision tree, wherever that is.
The decision tree. Yeah. Hey, I think it's up the street. It's right up the street.
Anyway, at the top of that tree, there's somebody that decides whether, their communion service is close enough to some others to allow a minister from that other denomination, to come into their church. Hold on. Lukey, come here. Come here.
Yeah, tell Lukey to behave himself.
Shut up. We're on a radio program. Come on.
Lukey, listen up.
Hey.
You see, John?
Yeah.
Be patient, John.
she's barking. She probably sees here. Mm-hmm. Oh, here comes someone to the meeting. Okay.
Oh, great. Great job. Welcome. Hello there, my friend. How are you?
Hey, James. How are you?
I'm fine. John Good. Case. That's John Case meet Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, well, John. How are you?
Good. Let me finish my introduction to the social justice panel that was held at Shepherd University on Tuesday night as part of John Unger's graduate class. He's teaching there in social justice in Appalachia, with a particular focus on Appalachian history and the history of social justice movements in Appalachia. And if you wanted to carry out a campaign for social justice on whatever issue you're highly motivated about, how would you go about doing it, given the history of the state? Anyway, so that was it's an interesting class, and they had all the students sort of running the tutorial, because supposedly their project was to try and take a social justice campaign of their preference. And develop a plan to go about interviewing expert people about the different people that they'd have to talk to, see whether there's enough agreement for to do anything about your very important issue. It's a cool concept, and we're there on behalf of AFL-CIO of West Virginia. And the president of the AFL-CIO was there, Josh Sword, and then we chimed in too, and then we had a great discussion and got all kinds of people sending me messages afterwards about they want to help out with our Labor Beat Radio program. I think we made a favorable impression anyway. I just gonna update you on that. John Unger is an interesting guy in our county.
I'd like to chime in. I'd like to weigh in on that because I have history with Pastor Unger. He was my pastor at one point. I attended all three of his churches probably 5 or 6 years ago when I lived in West Virginia. And we kind of developed a partnership in order to help people in need. And one of the things, let me digress a little. I first worked with him with Need to Feed, and we would feed the children all summer long in the playgrounds and schoolyards. So that's why I met Senator Unger. I was with Habitat for Humanity at that time. Anyway, fast forward back to now. When I was attending his churches where I met Madeline Albright and developed a relationship with her and her sister in church for a time. And then with Senator Unger, we talked about, he was senator at that time, pastor now, we developed the Recovery Coaches Association of West Virginia. And it's not an actual building or anything, but the first classes for that organization was held at one of the churches in Harpers Ferry. And I was one of the first graduates of the Recovery Coaches Association there. And now I think he's developed it into probably, it's a volunteer organization. And some people, the people that teach, that do the training, they get paid. But it's mostly all volunteers, mostly elderly people who've never used drugs in their life. And people that have a relationship or some kind of experience with drugs because of a loved one or prison or something like that. And it's pretty cool how it's coming full circle in West Virginia. But I don't know if it is making a lot of difference, a little bit of difference, or no difference at all. And I think that we could segue into what Elizabeth has to talk about on this issue. Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about yourself, and the mic is yours. Introduce yourself and just tell us about what it is that you do and how can we help?
Well, first of all, James and John, let me just thank you for inviting me to join you all this evening. It's a huge honor. And I've known James for a number of years now, and it's a pleasure to meet you, John. There is so much work to be done with trying to get our wonderful communities across West Virginia, across Appalachia, across the country and the world to recover from the onslaught of different medications that were given out so freely. And I know there's other issues with recovery, but that's one of the ones that I'm kind of focusing on now in my work is, the aftermath of the opioid epidemic. Just to introduce myself a little bit, my name's Elizabeth Granzo. I'm a social worker. I am really pleased to be part of the team at the Jefferson Berkeley Alliance, which is an organization of concerned people in the community who are very, interested in making a difference for the children that we have coming up in our culture and our community right now, as well as the adults who may have been impacted by substances and either are or are not in recovery. That is really important to us that we continue to serve in the community so that we can help people who are in recovery, but we also want to keep an eye and a heart out for the people who are not in recovery, but maybe someday. And we want to help them you know, live their best life, whatever that looks like for each person. So certainly a lot of us are advocates for recovery, but we also want to make sure that there are things like harm reduction and there is appropriate medical care and there are compassionate, loving neighbors surrounding people who are on that really difficult journey called addiction. So I work with Jefferson Berkeley Alliance and a coordinator of a grant there that allows us to serve in the community. It's a grant we just got in October. So I've been in this job a very short time. But my my background is mostly in disaster mental health. And I've done a lot of work in schools and a lot of work with young people. So this was an exciting opportunity for me to be in the West Virginia Panhandle and be working mm-hmm. on substance, you know, prevention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Elizabeth, can you expound on mental health crisis? You use the term, I don't think I said the right one. And the other one is, what is harm reduction? Let's start with harm reduction.
Okay. So harm reduction is a series of tools that allow us within a community to lessen the impacts of substances. So for example, when we carry Narcan and we're, you know, knowledgeable and available to use that, if we have a neighbor or a loved one, somebody on the street, it doesn't really matter, if we're able to help that person in the time when they are, you know, being really challenged by an overdose, we can, you know, help save their life. So that would be an example of harm reduction. Other parts of harm reduction are really any tool that you can put into place that will help a person to not experience as much harm from their substance use, which we need to go back to that understanding that substance use disorder is a disease. It's not a failing of your moral character. It is a disease like there are other types of diseases. So, you know, for example, in the arena of diabetes that we're usually familiar with, we know that there are medicines that help to regulate a person's system so that their diabetes does not impact them as much. That's harm reduction. And fortunately, as a culture and as a society, we're starting to advance more tools for our loved ones that have substance use disorder, that disease, so that they can, we can, you know, stop as much harm as possible. We definitely want to stop the harm that ends up costing the person their life. You know, the tragedies that happen and the lives that are cut short so early because of substance use disorder, you know, is one of West Virginia's saddest stories. So that's a little bit about harm reduction. And I'm not a specialist in that, but I work with people who are specialists in that. And that's what I've learned.
One person, my sister, Shannon, shout out to Shannon. Harm reduction.
Absolutely. The wonderful
best
Shannon
lady
Hicks.
In the field I ever worked with. Listen, I have a question. Recovery ready communities. It sounds that you're cultivating that kind of community with your collaboration and the group that you are working with and your vision and mission. What would a recovery ready community look like to you?
Yeah, I mean, I love communicating about the services that are possible for people that have substance use disorder. I have, you know, dear loved ones that are still with us, and I have loved ones that are lost to substance use disorder. So I've lived very up close and personal to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, Recovery Radio community is
the way I would see it is a way to communicate about the hope. You know, there lies within each of us a capacity to hope. We're born with the capacity to hope. And what occurs over time is different experiences take away from us that capacity to hope. And when you get hopeless and there are no other tools around you to reach out for encouragement, to reach out for, you know, a connection with another human, to reach out spiritually, when all those other tools seem non-available, a person can get into hopelessness. And that is a place of depression and suicidality, and, you know, is also a place where people use. They get very hopeless about the way their day is going to go if they don't have their substances that their body is craving. So that's, you know, I think that any kind of communication tool can be the source of hope for people, not only hope for that there's resources out there, that there's people who will drive you to treatment if you don't have, you know, those kinds of resources, that there are now recovery coaches in a lot of emergency rooms that you can talk to. I mean, all those are little, you know, important pieces of hope. Yeah, it's about
recovery,
it's about
capital.
Hope.
Recovery capital all the way, just going live. The dopamine and everything, just you can see it exploding in the air in the place where I work, Elizabeth and John, when hope is available to people. And hope, you know, hope that is seen is not hope at all, but you can feel it. You can feel how people get excited, you know, the body, the chemistry starts working for them and not against them.
So, that's so true. That's so true, James.
Yeah. So wedding planning would be a hopeful place to work. Tell us a little, because I know we were talking earlier about wedding.
Yes.
And I believe that when you encourage yourself, that is a good foundation for you. And so talk to us about some of your ideas and how does it fit into the job that you do in terms of cultivating the community and educating everybody around substance use disorder and then planning weddings, which is, I was trying to look up, is it Peaceful Mind Wedding Planning?
Yeah, so good? it's Peaceful Mind Weddings. And I thank you for mentioning that. It's weddings are kind of my passion. It's, you know, been something I've done. Well, I grew up, my family owned a florist, so I've always loved flowers. I've always arranged flowers. And, you know, I was probably, you know, worked on my first wedding when I was about 8. So that's something that's just really beautiful energy. The other tricky thing about weddings, though, is that it involves two humans. And those two humans come from two families. And, you know, families, sometimes they, you know, have struggles. I don't plan a wedding with anybody that I don't ask them about, does substance use disorder impact your family in any way? And will that impact your wedding day? And I'll give you an example. I have a couple that I'm working with, and one of their family members, who was actually the person that introduced them, is, you know, suffers from alcoholism that's very severe. And this person's not in recovery. And so we had to have a whole plan that would help them still have that family member at the wedding, but knowing that there's going to be a person who is watching out for the well-being of that family member during the wedding and during the reception. And we talked about, you know, even briefing the bartenders. And I know this sounds a little bit like, you know, trying to control the situation, but really what we're trying to do is mitigate up ahead of time by having a plan, a loving plan, is to mitigate a situation where this particular family member, you know, gets, you know, really ill during the wedding reception. And it's the couple's desire that they don't want to have to ask this person to leave or have them, you know, escorted out or any of those kind of things. So they're trying to put in some measures just for this one night to, you know, make sure that there's somebody who is, you know, really kind of working and supporting that one person who is not in recovery. And I have hired a recovery coach to work with that person, that family member, to just try and, you know, make sure that there's safety and love and support around that person so that they can enjoy the evening, but not, you know, not become ill.
Trauma sensitive and trauma informed.
Yes. No, really, we try very hard with that. Yes.
I really appreciate that, because that's universal and it can apply in a lot of situations with families, like a family of people who live together in a rehab. I'm having some difficulty, hierarchy difficulties and everything. So wedding planning, that whole conversation, Elizabeth, you know how I hear something, boy, and I put it right in there on the floor. So I thank you for that.
Yes, and, I appreciate
it. Yeah, people. So mediation. The mediation process.
Yes.
Yeah. Because we've mentioned putting together some training as mediators. How would that go?
Well, I tell you, mediation is one of my passions that I have had the blessing of learning about earlier in my career. And I'll tell you a little bit about that just briefly. And John, you don't know me, but before my career as a social worker, I worked in the fire department in Prince George's County outside of, you know, DC into Maryland. And I was one of the very first, not the first, but one of the first women hired. And there were two other women in a recruit class. And our particular class that was hired was over 50% African American. We were the first class of predominantly African American and three women to be hired under a consent decree by the Justice Department, because at the time, and I'm dating myself here, this was, you know, the very early 80s, the county, Prince George's County, which I love to this day, is a predominantly African American county, and almost the entire fire department was Caucasian. And what I learned from that experience was that even though we as a class were hired, you know, that a lot of my classmates had just really horrific time with prejudice and with them not being wanted by the predominantly Caucasian community that was the fire service at the time. So one of the things that I ended up developing, James, I don't even know if you know this, but one of the things I ended up developing was a peer mediation team. And what we did was when there would be a problem, either something that was sexual harassment oriented or something that was racial harassment oriented, is that we would, of course, have education around that, but we also would bring the parties together and have a mediation about what kind of harms, you know, were being done, what kind of perceptions were, you know, being, you know, what kinds of messages were being perceived by the way that people were talking to one another. And I have to be frank with you, it was quite direct. You know, I was told many times that I needed to quit because I was holding a job that should belong to a man who was trying to support his family. And I would be like, okay, all righty then. But my point is that, you know, it was not subtle, and it was not subtle for my African-American friends in my class either. Mm. But what we did, and this was over, you know, 15, 18 years worth of work, is that when these disputes would come up, mm-hmm. we would bring a team in, and we would work with the both parties, mm-hmm. and then we would bring the parties together, and we had a very structured mediation sequence that we went and got certified in. I'm no longer certified in that, but my point is that we didn't just wing it. We went and got education mm-hmm. and certification, and we would have a classic mediation situation. And you know what I learned from that sticks with me to this day is that mm-hmm. when you bring two people into that kind of a process where there's a lot of reflective listening, where you ask each party to talk about how it felt when certain things were said to them or done to them. When you kind of take people through that kind of a scenario, very step by step, it really gets to the heart of both participants. And I've seen a lot of people cry. I've seen a lot of people say, you know, I am not a hateful person. I didn't mean that, but it was funny at the time. And, you know, so there's a lot of course correction that has to happen when you put people together from different backgrounds and you want them to work together when one side of the fence doesn't really want the other side of the fence to be there. So that's what I know about mediation.
And that's a good bit. That is a good, that's a lot. That is good. That fits right with what I need, actually. So, John, what are your thoughts, John? What are you thinking over there? Because I know you, labor part.
Well, the fire department across the country, you know, are quite a bit similar to police departments. Mm. And also to certain trades, where historically, you know, the people who got jobs and they got them as political favors because they're political jobs. I mean, you know, they're both firefighting and police work are normally supposedly run by the mayor. There's sometimes some doubt about that. Who's really running the New York City Police Department, for example. Michael Bloomberg, one of the fourth richest men in the world, you know, who was mayor too, said he wasn't sure who was running the police department. You know, so there you go. Anyway, and so people hire their relatives, you know, and cousins and whatever in these early labor kind of crap unions, you know, especially in the public sector where there was usually some political payoff to some ward, you know, bosses, set of bosses or city that did this. Smaller towns, I don't know, it's probably a little bit different, but big towns is like that. And it's taken tons of lawsuits to break that almost everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure it has been broken in a number of places. I mean, there's been accommodations, but I mean, one of the biggest lawsuits filed years ago was in Minneapolis, but then 25 years later, you know, the cops are still killing people on the street. Okay. I mean, so it's not quite clear that it worked.
we need some harm reduction around the whole system.
So labor movement, you know, the leadership of the labor movement has changed dramatically over the years relative to that question. If you were looking at 1960, the top executive committee of the AFL-CIO was probably, even though most of the workers were represented nationally, were in industrial unions, meaning everybody that works at the place is in the same union, okay, as opposed to everybody that's in a certain craft has their own special grade. Well, if you were an industrial union, you only had, I think, 8 or 9 seats on the executive board, and there was 30 seats there, including a union like the cigar makers from which Lane Kirkland came from, that had about 5 members left in the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they had a seat on the executive board because it was inherited from way back in 1880 or 90 or whatever. And so you had to, you know, structurally, there's been a number of upheavals in the labor movement. And I think ever since Sweeney and Trumka got elected in the 90s there, that it got better.
Yeah. There's a lot of trauma going around, a lot of moral injury that's afoot in this country, and it's happening, and it's very subtle. You know, people are injured, and the injury turns into anger and so many other things. And I was just glancing at the Peaceful Mind wedding planning site, and I'd like to share something because I found an interest. It says, I chatted with a young lady today and I had so much empathy for what she's going through. She had a panic attack at her bachelorette event. Now, that what does that look like, Elizabeth? What actions would a person take?
You know, James, this is something that I really try and help people with, because, and I'll answer your question about what does a panic attack look like, but so many of our younger people who are getting into this thing called marriage is also entering this thing where, you know, you've got to have this 4 or 5 day bachelorette getaway that's, you know, everybody participating has to, you know, be able to spend thousands of dollars to go to this. And there's all kinds of hoopla around it. I'm not saying that that practice in and of itself is problematic, but what I'm saying is that not everybody can or should try to put a bar that's that high up and that expensive in terms of being part of, you know, supporting somebody during their wedding. But I have had, so it's so interesting that you talk about that, because I have really worked with a number of different people who had a panic attack at their bachelorette. And I think that there's a lot of pressure during that time to, first of all, to drink and drug a lot. There's a lot of pressure to, you know, have kind of the quote unquote time of your life, of whatever that's supposed to look like. And, you know, I'm not 20 something anymore. I'm 60 something now. So, you know, the way that is seen by the younger generation as the time of your life, I don't know what that definition is, but it almost always involves substances, and it almost always involves a situation where you're away, you're on a trip, or you're at some other, you know, part of your state at least. And people feel very pressured to do things that they normally wouldn't do. That being said, a panic attack feels like a heart attack. It's where your body responds to the extreme anxiety so profoundly that you start not being able to breathe, you start feeling lightheaded, you start feeling like you're going to pass out. Sometimes you do pass out. It is an overtaking of your system that's not a heart attack, but it mimics it, and it is terrifying for people who have that. Some people have something called, you know, panic disorder, and some people have a panic attack and then they never have another one. So it doesn't grow into an ongoing disorder, but it is a horrible experience for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And talk to us a little bit about this. This is Recovery Radio, and we discuss substance use disorder always on this podcast.
Yes.
Talk about the pills. You and I were talking about the evolution of the drug epidemic here in the United States, how it evolves into things. And so talk to us about the what we should be watching out for. Educate us about the pills and the new ways they're being manufactured.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that we're really focusing on with the young people, is that there is a whole new industry, and in many cases it can even be a cottage industry, where people are manufacturing counterfeit pills, and they can get a pill press that makes something look just like an Adderall or just like a Bayer aspirin or just like whatever they want it to. And then especially with the kids, what's happening, and it happens with adults also, but a lot of times the younger people, they think they're taking their cousins, you know, Adderall, and they think that's going to be a neat thing to experience. Adderall being a medication that's prescribed to people for a number of things, but their attention deficit is one thing. And the younger people are taking these called counterfeit pills or pressed pills, and they're laced with fentanyl. They have all kinds of junk in it, everything from cement to metals to just all kinds of literally scrap materials in it that they, you know, can use to make it look like a pill. They did some testing with pharmacists, and it's even hard for pharmacists to tell these counterfeit pills from the real thing. So, you know, the kids and the adults who are getting these pills are thinking that they're getting something very innocent that was prescribed for somebody their age and something that, you know, has got a small amount of, you know, whatever. And they're taking it and they're overdosing immediately, you know, because it has enough fentanyl in it to either, you know, cause them to overdose or, you know, tragically to cause, you know, to cause them to die. We have had child deaths in the Eastern Panhandle from counterfeit pills already. There have also been overdoses from kids who just took one pill one time. And it's because they don't know what they're taking. And so we're trying to get the word out to as many people who will listen to us that there's a problem going on with the drug supply right now. And we're, you know, it's been labeled by a number of different, you know, sources as one pill can kill. But that's that's what we need to get out there, is
one pill just 'cause you, kill.
Just because you think you know what you're taking, you may not know what you're taking, and it may be loaded with, you know, fentanyl or, you know, other really damaging, you know, elements that are, you know, can be lethal.
Laced. Stuff is laced.
It's absolutely.
And you know, and I thought what you said was so profound a second ago about the kids believe that there's something that was made for a child. And they color it, make it colors and pretty.
Yes.
If it's made for a child, then, you know, it's safe for me. This is what I'm supposed to be taking. This kind.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, and they talk about it that way. What is the drug that's on the streets that's eating up the skin? So one guy, well, I'm not going to say this because they're going to listen to it at work, so I can't. But
it's called xylazine.
But what is it called?
It's called xylazine.
Xylazine.
It's xy, like it starts with an X, like xylophone. It's xylazine.
Xylazine. Got it.
And it causes the most horrific wounds. And you got to understand, you know, I ran calls for 20 years with some really bad situations, gunshots and everything else. And it causes horrific wounds on a person's body. And the thing about it that we're seeing with some of the street medicine work is that, you know, these are infections that are really, really hard to cure. And they're coming out on the body unrelated to where the injection site was. It used to be thought that for people that were injecting, that the xylazine was just causing that spot to break out, right? But but that's not accurate. So then it became known fact that the xylazine will cause a breakout anywhere on your body that it damn well pleases. And that you have no control over that. And now they are starting to put the xylazine in these pressed pills. So, you know, apparently, and I've not utilized it, but apparently, you know, some people are drawn to the fentanyl, xylazine, and other elements of what's in the drug supply now, because it's a better kick. But you know, somebody who is in the eighth grade and 95 pounds and, you know, they don't have any drug tolerance at all built up in their body, they're going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe somebody who's, you know, cultivated a high drug tolerance and they're, you know, further along in age and they're, you know, more, just used to the substances in their body, they may die from it, but they may also be able to, you know, just overdose and not have it be so bad. But the kids that are trying it are running into trouble.
Wow. Yeah, that is really, really good information. I certainly appreciate it. So we're coming up on 5:50, Johanna. You have anything you want to add, John, before we just start joking around here? And Elizabeth, you have to go or something like
well,
that?
We
usually stop at 6 o'clock, but I got more questions for Elizabeth. But
I have the one I always ask.
Yeah, go ahead.
And that is, how much is the substance abuse directly related to poverty?
John, I think it's dramatically directly related to poverty. I think it's dramatically directly related to any pain point that a kid goes through that causes them to feel uncertain and insecure, you know, whether it's that they're couch surfing and they're going house to house and their housing isn't secure, whether their food supply isn't secure, whether they, you know, feel awkward and ashamed when they go to school because they're, you know, wearing shoes that are two sizes too big because they're trying to fit into brother's hand-me-downs, whatever it is. I feel like the poverty brings on to children anyway. And kids will tell you this if you do work in the schools and you talk to them, it brings on a lot of shame. It brings in, you know, so much uncertainty that they really go into school. School is their only certainty, but they arrive at school hungry. Even with the breakfast services that we now have acknowledged in our country that kids need, you know, a lot of times the kids that are at the highest need, the parents or the guardians or whatever, can't get them there in time for the breakfast thing for whatever reason. So we have kids, you know, coming to the classroom door where they're supposed to be ready to learn and they're hungry. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they're not appropriately dressed for the weather. So, you know, they're cold all day or they're, you know, being in social work in the schools, you know, you spend so much of your time mitigating the way that the kids show up for school in an effort to try and help them, you know, raise their ability to just concentrate during the school day. A lot of kids come to school sleep deprived because their parents, you know, have, you know, been partying all night or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the impact of poverty, substances, food insecurity, all of that just wraps up into a big nauseating ball that sits in their stomach.
when they're trying to do their math. Yeah. So I think it's a direct relationship. I've seen it my whole career as a direct relationship.
Is there any program of or any remedy or set of remedies, reforms, that if they don't do something about poverty, can still have a meaningful effect? Or is doing something about poverty the first thing that should be happening? I'm trying to think about this.
Yeah, I think that some of the mechanisms that we have for kids that are in poverty are going in the right direction. But one of the things that I think we're woefully lacking is mental health in the schools. And there's a lot of pioneering going on in that relationship between, helping kids to at least feel comfort and support at school so that they can, maybe ride the wave at home. That's not such a fun wave. And then they know that they can come back to school and count on, their meal and their nurture and, some things like that. I know that there's also a very direct correlation between depression and substances, anxiety and substance use. And one of the things that I feel is essential, and we're addressing this at JBA, the Jefferson Berkeley Alliance, is that we're not only working on getting the prevention messages out to the kids about how unfortunate it can be to become addicted to something. We're also trying to get a lot of work into the schools related to children having better mental health. We're working with a program in Berkeley County, and we're trying to get it started in Jefferson County. I have meetings about it next week, as a matter of fact, a very evidence-based, very strong program called Sources of Strength. And it is the concept behind it is simple. It's about teaching children a number of different strengths that we all have within ourselves and that we can lean into when we feel stress. Having a trusted adult in your life, for example, and for a lot of kids, that's their teacher or their school counselor. There's nobody on their home front that they would put in that category, sadly. Some of the other sources of strength are exercise, some kind of a spiritual program, which we look at as something that lifts your spirit. Doesn't have to be related to religion, but so we're working really hard to get Sources of Strength as a program and to support the children in the panhandle so that when they have a stressor, and they can make a choice either between using substances or leaning into one of their strengths, they will understand and know how to lean into their strength instead of using. So the kids are under Herculean levels of stress. And it's not just the families that have substance use, it's other family issues as well. And when they come to school, they're just on the struggle bus. I don't know how else to put it.
Struggle bus. That is very artfully chosen words. I like that. The struggle bus. We got to get off the struggle bus.
Yeah.
Make it turn it into a challenge. This mindfulness mind fitness training and how to ground and release and your window of tolerance need to be opened wider when you go and you're hungry and you're rejected and neglected and stuff in there. So your window gets smaller and smaller and smaller. You show up at school with dingy, dirty clothes on, and the kids start talking about, da-dun-da-duns. He got on da-dun-da-duns. Those kinds of things. And children can be really horrible to one another. And
they can.
I said, I forgot how horrible I probably used to be. I don't remember a lot of the stuff I did, but I'm sure I picked on people and girls in particular, pulling their hair. But the thing now is really kids are becoming predators. There's predatory behavior going on. It's crowding. They're wondering, they're looking at one another. And there's a lot of moral injury going on with our kids.
Absolutely.
That we don't even address. We don't even talk about that. But let's switch in gears because we're just about out of time here. But I want to, Elizabeth, really quickly, can you tell our listeners a little bit about the quick response team that was dismantled some time ago? But how do you feel what did we learn? And also, can you talk a little bit about... Yeah, go ahead with the quick response team, and I'll remember the other question as you go.
Yeah, so I'm a really big believer in quick response teams, and the idea behind them is that when you have somebody who's had an actual overdose and the ambulance or some other, you know, entity intervenes and brings them back, that is the time, and that's been proven by a lot of programs, that the person is in a space where they're most afraid of their substance use and probably a unique moment where they might consider treatment. And so the idea behind quick response is that, you know, within 24 hours, you get a team of knowledgeable, trained people out to meet with that person if they're willing, because it's all about, you know, people have to make their own choices. But if they're willing, you let them know what the resources are in the community and that they could get help and they could, you know, not be in that situation again. If they would like the help, they, you know, here's how you can access it. And here's what we're here to do to help you. We didn't get that up and running in Jefferson County, but But there's definitely success going on with that in Berkeley County right now and in Morgan County.
And other
wonderful counties in West Virginia and across Appalachia. So it's, you know, it's one of those beacons of hope, mm-hmm. is to reach out to that person when they are most likely open, mm-hmm. to doing something different. You know, and you're there handing them the resources and holding their hand and walking them through the door if that's what they want to do.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit about the response.
Yeah. You remember the one client we had, I forget the other young lady that was on the team. She went with me to the person's house and her son had overdosed. And I think he worked for the sanitation department.
Okay.
I still talk to that lady. I talked to her about a year or so ago. I call her every now and then. But her son died 2 days later. I don't know if you remember. He overdosed on his way from work, pulled over in his car, and he was one of ours. And so I have his name and all that information in the archive. You and I, we can talk about it later on because, you know, I really feel like after talking to you again, I know I got to work with you. Again, I do. For me, there's so much going on that, you know, I feel responsible for a lot of good stuff. I made a lot of good contacts and friends when I was in West Virginia, and my heart is still there. So,
well, that's
with the other question I had,
yes.
was. Tell us really quickly about your relationship with boxing.
Oh yes. So when I was in college and I had taken my EMT class for the first time, emergency medical technician, I became what's called a cut man in the corner at a youth boxing organization. And I loved that job. It wasn't very often that the kids would, you know, have a situation where they needed a Band-Aid or whatever, some kind of intervention for their cuts. They weren't that bad, but I loved the enthusiasm that the kids had
and just to see like their focus and their, you know, they love learning about the discipline and everything that it takes to, you know, to box, and just the whole respect for the other party and, you know, your competition. It was a really cool learning experience for kids. So I'm a big supporter of youth boxing for the kids that want to do that. You know, not every kid wants to do that. That's fine.
But there are a lot of them that want to do it.
Yes. And I think it's a great release for all of the frustration that we as human beings build up. So,
well, we're going to find a place for a gym down in Berkeley or Jefferson County.
I really want to do that.
100%. And I've been talking about that. Yeah. So with that, that's what a great way to end the show. And I really enjoyed listening and hearing and learning.
Yeah.
John, how about you?
Oh, it's a great conversation. And I, you know, it's very interesting, your remarks about boxing and how, for people in stress, especially from, you know, a lot of dysfunctional families, I can see how so clearly how it could play a very positive role.
Absolutely.
You're going to get the liberal establishment is going to oppose it.
So Elizabeth writes grants, John. We're going to have to get a round table going on and see what we can do, you know?
I know.
Yeah. All right. Here we go.
Good luck.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah.
I was supportive.
All right. Here we go. Okay.
Thank you both, John. Gentlemen. Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Don't be a stranger, though, Elizabeth.
Okay. I'll work on it.
All right. We're going to do this.
We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. You're listening to Recovery Radio on Enlighten Radio at www.enlightenradio.org. And you can also listen to us broadcasting, usually 24/7. There's some maintenance moments that do take place at player.enlightenradio.org. And that'll show up even right on your phone, too. So take care. It's late.
All right.
But everything comes next. Out.